are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
This is your 50,000-watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Nevada Wolfpack alums here in the Central Valley, tired of people saying Nevada, we get touchy about that, 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN, Fresno.com. Your Friday morning two-hour tour begins right now, 4 minutes, 30 seconds past the hour of 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Good morning to you. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Foggy morning to start your day here in the Central Valley. I'm sounding a little bit like Kopi, giving you the morning. Well, I could never sound as good as Kopi, giving you the morning weather outlook. It is a little foggy out there. Take it a little slower out on the roads. Technical director, producer, hockey guy, Sharks fan, Sharks Giants guy, too. Wonder how he feels about, I haven't asked him about, you know, the new name, Oracle Park versus, it's like, well, who cares? Have you seen the have you seen the sign, though? Because I said it yesterday. When you look at it, it looks like Oriole Park. I mean, it's pretty close to it. But, of course, we're talking about Russ, keeping the program going in the right direction, as he always does. On the program this morning, last one for the week, our encore, bottom of the hour, Brian Richardson. He was part of, it was the Gang of Seven, then it was the Gang of Six, and at times it was the Gang of Eight. But they were the Bullmageddon guys. And you recall that they came on the program before they set out on their, they wanted to do 18 bowl games in 22 days. It turned out to be, I believe, 15. The 15th game was the national championship this past Monday up at Levi Stadium, Santa Clara. And they're still talking about going to the Senior Bowl, but Brian gave us sort of a recap. And some of the highs and lows of the trip was good stuff. So you'll hear Brian at 7:35, 8:05 Friday picks. We've got four games for you. The NFL playoffs, a couple games tomorrow, a couple games on Sunday. Russ, what time is that Bears game? Wait, never mind. Bears aren't playing this weekend. A little bitter about that. Still, I'm working through it. I should be through this by the time the Super Bowl is over. And then at 8:35, Nick Shager with some movies to let you know about, and also a cool series that's coming out as well. So a couple of things I wanted to get to this morning. I don't know how many of you, and this is leading up to, follow me here for a moment, this is leading up to Fresno State. I don't know how many of you had a chance last night, if you're near a TV and maybe you turned on, you maybe had an itch to turn on some basketball. UCLA was playing Oregon. And the Ducks at one point led by 17. 7 minutes, about 7 minutes and change to go. The Ducks led by 17. I'm hearing from my good buddy Justin Phillips, who covers the Ducks. He's one of the prime guys who covers everything that goes on with Oregon Athletics. And he was sending me some pictures of Matt Arena. And you know, things are going great because he knows that I went to SC. And he was happy to tell me that the Ducks were winning. I mean, I'm not a Ducks fan, but happy to see that UCLA was losing. Yeah, but, you know, it's whatever. It's just trading notes back and forth. They're up 17. So I decided to turn it on, and the lead shrunk a little bit, shrunk down to 13 with 2 minutes to play. And as I'm watching this, it was clear that Oregon wasn't working out right for them. Every time they were coming up court, they were missing. It turned out they made just four of their final 21 attempts from the field. Nevertheless, Oregon had the game under control. And we got to the final minute. Oregon's up nine. on UCLA. No problem. Game's going to get put away. But that wasn't what happened. That wasn't what happened at all. UCLA managed to overcome a 9-point deficit in the final minute and actually had a chance to win the game. Chris Smith got a 3-point play with just under a second to go. Referees ended up putting 0.4 on the clock. Chris Smith could have won it at the line, missed it. Game went to overtime, as you would imagine. UCLA won that game 87-84. According to ESPN stats and information, it tied, in terms of the final comeback, or the nine-point comeback in the final minute, it tied for the sixth largest final-minute comeback in Division I history. Texas A&M coming back from, I remember this game, too. I remember this tournament game back in 2016. Texas A&M, they were down 12 to Northern Iowa. Texas A&M was a huge favorite in that game. Northern Iowa just fell apart in the last minute. And, I mean, it was three-pointer, turnover, three-pointer, turnover. It was crazy. But that remains the biggest deficit to overcome with less than a minute remaining. So UCLA is now 3-0 since firing head coach Steve Alford and promoting Murray Bartow. So why do I mention this? Well, Murray Bartow, let's go back a little bit for a second. Murray Bartow's father, Gene Bartow. Gene had done 4 years at Memphis State. While he was there, that included taking Memphis State. Of course, it's Memphis now, University of Memphis, but it was Memphis State then. They wore black back in the day, black jersey. You know, the colors were black. They eventually changed to that blue that they wear now. But they, Coach Gene Bartow was one of the better, if not one of the best coaches in America. And he took that team to the final against UCLA. That was the Bill Walton. That was the Bill Walton-led UCLA team. That was an unbelievable UCLA team. And they UCLA just dominated that game, 87-66. That was the night that Walton, game was in St. Louis, if memory serves, but that was the night that Walton had 44, including going 21 for 22 from the field. That was a ridiculous night, just an unbelievable night. And a lot of people going into that game thought that Memphis State had a chance to win. UCLA put the kibosh on that pretty quickly. Nevertheless, you had Gene Bartow. You had Gene Bartow, who had 4 years at Memphis State, and then he went to Illinois. He went 8-18 at Illinois. He had a 5-year contract there, but UCLA came calling. John Wooden wins his last title, 1975, and Gene Bartow got called. They overlooked the 8-18 season because they thought this guy can coach, and he could coach. He could coach. Well, he gets to UCLA. He has 2 seasons at UCLA. Now, remember, these are the first 2 seasons after John Wooden's 10 titles in 12 years. And the idea was, if you're speaking as a UCLA person, we're just going to keep winning titles. We're going to keep knocking them out. We've got a system here. Well, it didn't work out that way. But Gene Bartow got there, and in his 2 years, he went 52-9, finishing ranked 5th in the nation and 2nd in the nation. The year he was 2nd in the nation, that was when his UCLA Bruins lost to Indiana in the national championship game. And if I remember right, Russ, you'd have to check me on that, but if I remember right, it was the 1976 Indiana Hoosiers. But if you give it a quick look, I think that was an undefeated team. I think Indiana went undefeated in that year, 75-76, right in there. But he had a lot of support. Gene Bartow had a lot of support. Among them was John Wooden. John Wooden was a big supporter of Gene Bartow. But Gene Bartow came to work every day feeling a lot of pressure, feeling the pressure of not being John Wooden. And even 52-9, you're talking about taking over a program that won 10 years. Thank you, Russ. 32-0, that Indiana team. You're talking about taking over a program that had won like nobody had ever won before in any other sport. And as Gene Bartow would say later on, he went to work every day frustrated, uncomfortable, a little edgy, because from the fan base he was hearing it. Yeah, you finished fifth. You took us to the national championship game, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Well, his son, Murray, grew up in the shadow of UCLA, and then obviously he got offered to go to UAB and essentially start the athletic program at UAB and coach at UAB, and that's what he did. And Murray Bartow grew up, in a basketball family. Well, Murray Bartow was an assistant on Steve Alford's staff. Steve Alford got fired on, December 31st or so? And of the assistants on the team, which include Dwayne Broussard and Tyus Edney, Tyus Edney, of course, one of the better point guards that UCLA ever had. UCLA chose Murray Bartow to take over. They've gone 3-0 since he took over. 92-70 win over Stanford, 98-83 win over Cal, and then last night's pretty stunning comeback over Oregon. But here's why I bring this up. Because you have a team, they got together, the assistants got together, and as Murray Bartow said, we're not the thickest bunch of guys. We're not at times the grittiest bunch of guys, but we do have speed. We do have length, we do have athleticism, and we do have depth. We've got those four things. He's taken the same group of guys that looked a little lethargic, that looked a little disorganized, that didn't look all that talented, even though Steve Alford's teams, were always in the mix, they didn't always look great. Well, he's taken the same guys and turned them into a team that is suddenly a little bit more on the, I'm not going to say electrifying side, but there's certainly more electricity when UCLA is out there. They look different. The feel that you have of UCLA is they're different. Yeah, they were down 12 early on. They were down 17 with 7 minutes to go. But they kept playing. They kept coming at Oregon over and over and over. Which brings me to Justin Hutson. It's so similar to watching this basketball team play. Last year at this time, this Fresno State men's basketball team, after 15 games, was 11-4. Right now, Fresno State sitting at 12-3, getting ready for what will, at least to this point, be the biggest game of the year. It's going to be the biggest home game of the year, hands down. As Coach Q said yesterday, there isn't another game that's going to be on the hardwood at Save Mart Center that's going to be bigger than this one. Oh, they're going to have some other good home games. No doubt about that. Boise State's coming in January 19th. That game's at Boise. Forgive me. Boise State's coming in February 13th. My mistake. San Diego State's going to be coming in. Some good games, but this game tomorrow night is the big one. But the team is only a one game difference from last year at this time. Justin Hutson came in largely the same lineup. Obviously, there's a couple of difference makers in there, but the bulk of the team is the same. But when you watch this 12-3 team versus last year's 11-4 team at this time, after 15 games, how many of you look at this team the same way as last year? I'm going to say hardly any of you, if not none of you, because this team looks different. And it points up exactly what's gone on at UCLA with Murray Bartow. Yeah, it's been three games, but it hasn't taken long to see how different that team looks. And then you look at Fresno State, and last year, the thing for me that stuck out, and let me just get this out of the way right now. Every time we talk about Fresno State last year, it seems to come with it, Rodney Terry was a great guy. Right, he was. But this is about results. And great guy or not, Fresno State basketball last year lost too many games they should have won. All right? They lost too many games they should have won. Evansville, they should have won that game. Hands down. Should have won that game. Oregon, should have won that game. Utah State, the game they lost in overtime, should have won that game. Boise State, lost by 6 at home, should have won that game. One after another after another. Utah State up in Logan, should have won that game. Losing at home to Wyoming was a terrible loss. Losing in overtime at Albuquerque should have won that game. Every team, unless, you know, unless you just have a magical season and go undefeated, every team, every program is going to have games that you can say should have won, but, you know, it got away from them. That's just the way it is. I mean, you can look at this year right now and probably look at the Miami game. Maybe not say they should have won it. It could have won it. It was a great game, though. I watched that game start to finish. It was a great game. Utah Valley, it's a bad loss. But you look at everything else this team has done and point your compass to Justin Hutson. They are not only beating every team they should beat, they are pounding them. Last year, Tennessee Martin coming in here, that would have been a 10 or 15 point game. Fresno State won by 40. Last year, Cal coming in here, that would have been a close game. Fresno State won by 22. Beat Long Beach State by 21. Beat Weber State by 19. You know, Pacific, that was a game last year. Pacific came in here and gave it everything they had. It was a great game. It was a close game. It was an overtime game. Last year, Fresno State loses that game. Fresno State won that game. It was a gritty performance. You look at what Justin Hutson has done with this basketball program, this team, and I've said it a number of times and I'll say it again, they're playing with creativity, they're playing with passion, with energy, with intensity, they're having a great time out on the court. Yeah, Deshaun Taylor, you know, slapping hands with some of the Utah State fans, basically saying to them, hey, you guys were pretty cool. Great effort on your part. Went on Twitter and did the same thing. I mean, when you see guys on a team that are doing that, you have to smile. You have to love that. That's what this team has going. They are out. I mean, mind you, it's a little bit of organized chaos. You know, when they're sweeping the boards, they're bringing the ball up court, they're in transition, they are looking to score. But it's not a run-and-gun, haphazard style. There is structure. But within that structure, Justin Hutson has given these guys the freedom that Murray Bartow has given UCLA's players. The freedom that he's given them is to do what they do best, and that is use their athleticism to their advantage. Don't bottle them up. You know, there were so many teams you look at around the country, you watch how a coach has got them playing, and you see guys who are athletic. They're long, they're lean, they can jump out of the gym, they can shoot it from anywhere, and yet you'll see them playing in a style that clearly doesn't fit them. This team is playing in the style that fits them. And just out of sheer curiosity, I did want to take a look and see how UTEP was doing, because that's where Rodney Terry took over. And I don't know anything about this team this year. I don't know what kind of talent base they have. The only thing I know is I did go and take a peek to see how they're doing. They're 5-9 right now. They're 0-3 in conference, which is neither here nor there relative to Fresno State. But to put a button on this team, I hope you're going to come out and watch this team tomorrow. This is a game that I don't think this team's going to win. Can they win? Yes, they can. Can they beat Nevada? Absolutely. But they have to play beyond their best game. They've got to play out of their minds at both ends of the court. They don't have any room for error against this 10th-ranked Nevada Wolfpack team, because that is a good basketball team. Forget about the pounding they took at New Mexico. As Coach Q said, Eric Musselman realized that game was getting away from him, and he just said, "Yeah, we're gonna take a beating. I'm gonna let my guys stand out there on the court, work, you know, up and down the court, and I'm gonna let them feel what a crowd mocking them feels like. I'm gonna let them feel embarrassed in our navy blue uniforms, because I want them to remember that going forward. They're gonna come in here, you know, they destroyed San Jose State the other night by 39. They're coming in here hungry." They're looking at Fresno State as the team that's looking to take them off the perch. They will be in here motivated and ready to go. Fresno State has to be the same, and one of the things that's going to help them is if there's a big crowd. I'm not talking about 5,000, 6,000. I'm hoping there's 10,000, 12,000 people in there. Of course, that would also force getting those damn curtains down. But it is going to be a good game. And again, the difference in what Justin Hutson has done with this team, with these young men, is striking. Win or lose tomorrow, you're going to see a great effort from Fresno State. It's Friday. It's the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Coming up in about 10 minutes, Brian Richardson, part of the Bullmageddon gang, got together, had a chat. He was tailgating at Levi's Stadium in advance of Alabama and Clemson. And as I said at the opening of the program today, we had talked to Brian about their adventure, him and his group of fellow USC alums trying to see 18 games, 18 bowl games in 22 days. They ended up seeing 15, the 15th being the game on Monday night. But it was fun to hear a recap of him. We have an encore every week. It's at about 7:35 or thereabouts, and that's what you'll hear. I had a conversation with our good friend Keont Myers from ESPN Central Texas yesterday, and one of the things we were talking about was Kyler Murray and what the Arizona Cardinals are going to do with their first choice in the draft. And Keont and I are coming at this from a little bit different. As you heard yesterday, Keont doesn't think there's any way Arizona will take him, and I think that's probably the logical lean. But a couple of things that I want to throw into the mix here, because I know they have Josh Rosen, but consider that Cliff Kingsbury is their coach now, and he's going to have a lot of say in who they decide to choose. Kingsbury back in October said this about Kyler Murray. Kyler, I mean, he's a freak, man. Kyler is a freak. I followed him since he was a sophomore in high school. Just think the world of him and what he can do on a football field. I've never seen one better in high school, and he's starting to show it now at the college level. I don't have enough good things to say about him. He's phenomenal. I've never seen him have a poor outing, not one, which at quarterback is impossible to do, but he's done it. I'd take him with the first pick of the draft if I could. I know he's signed up to play baseball, but he is a dominant football player, and I would take him with the first pick. This is Cliff Kingsbury, your Arizona Cardinals coach, saying this 3 months ago. And then just throw this into the mix, too, because Adam Schefter from ESPN, he's right. He's right when he says this. The one thing about the NFL is that quarterbacks are currency. And I can tell you this. Last year when the Cleveland Browns had the first and fourth overall picks, at one point in time, and I know people will be skeptical of this, and as we later found out, by the way, this was true because the Browns said as much. But Schefter continues, the Browns considered taking quarterbacks at 1 and 4 and then auctioning off one of the quarterbacks that they liked less. So if you're the Arizona Cardinals and you like Kyler Murray that much, and also imagine him going number 1 overall, but maybe there's a scenario where you get him and you auction off Josh Rosen. If that's what the new coach likes, if that's what he wants, why would you not acquiesce to that when you could get a king's ransom for Josh Rosen? And that was my point yesterday, saying let's not be so fast to say that the Arizona Cardinals wouldn't do this, because Kingsbury's the guy. And Kingsbury, remember, when he was coaching at Texas Tech, yeah, he watched Kyler Murray's career, and by all accounts, by anybody who has seen this young man in high school, remember, he didn't lose a game. In his 3 years as a starter, he didn't lose a game, and he won three straight titles. And for people to say that he is the best player to ever come out of high school football in the state of Texas, that is saying something. And then, of course, he goes to Oklahoma, backs up Baker Mayfield, wins the Heisman this year. He sees the spotlight. He's been electric. Now he's contemplating. He's probably going to put his name into the NFL draft. But what will Cliff Kingsbury do? I don't think it's nearly as far-fetched as some think that he potentially, if he likes him that much, and this is a guy, Kingsbury's a guy who, I mean, this is a guy who mentored and developed Pat Mahomes. If he thinks that much of Kyler Murray, and if he believes, I can do some things with this young man, I don't care that he's 5'10", I can do, or 5'9", right in there, I can do some things with this young man. You know, he's getting there. Josh Rosen is there. Josh Rosen is a very talented guy. Of the guys on the board last year, the only guy that I, for me, for the quarterbacks that came out, for me, the only guy that I had below him of the upper tier guys was Lamar Jackson in terms of what I thought down the road was going to be a success rate. I was not nearly as high on Josh Rosen, and it has nothing to do with the fact that he went to UCLA. Let's get that out of the way right now. But I wasn't nearly as high on Josh Rosen as a lot of others were. He's obviously an incredibly talented young man. But given the right situation, I think that Kyler Murray can have some great success. So let's not write off the possibility that Kingsbury is going to just pass on him. Because again, when they get their war room together, as they like to call it, for the NFL draft, and if Murray is in fact in the draft, you know, you've got Dwayne Haskins out there already. But the connection that Kingsbury has with Kyler Murray is pretty significant when you realize what he said about him. And it's not the first time, it's not the only time that he's talked about Kyler Murray. But if he goes in there as the newly anointed head coach and he's talking to the ownership, he's talking to GM, talking to the director of player personnel, and they all say their piece about what they think should happen and who they want. If Kingsbury says, fellas, he's in the draft, this is who I'm taking, this is what we need to do, then the thought is right. If that's the guy he wants, they could get a fortune back in the way of players, draft choices, or what have you for Josh Rosen. That's a scenario that's out there. I'm not saying they're going to take him, but I am saying it is a possibility simply because of him being the guy who loves Kyler Murray, who has watched him for years, and now he's in a position to take him. And none of us know whether or not he looks at Josh Rosen. Take Kyler Murray out of the equation for a second. No one really knows what he thinks, being the quarterback guru that he is, what he believes the long-term success possibility is for Josh Rosen. Who knows? We'll see. Coming up, it's our Encore of the Week. Brian Richardson, the head of the Bullmageddon Gang. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up at the top of the hour, Friday picks. We've got four of them coming your way today. Gives us, Tony Landry and myself, Tony from SiriusXM, a lot more time to give you the kind of expert analysis that you have come to know and love on this program. We have an encore every Friday at 7:35. We like to bring back someone who we talked to earlier in the week because we thought it was a pretty good conversation, and maybe for folks on Friday mornings, they didn't get a chance to hear it. In this case, this week, talked with our guy from Bullmageddon, the Bullmageddon Gang. This is a former USC student. Him and his USC buddies all got together and went to what ended up being 15 bowl games in 22 days. This is Brian Richardson. Prior to bowl season, I had a chance to talk with Brian Richardson. He and a group of former Southern California USC alums decided to try and go to 18 bowl games, including one internationally in the Bahamas, in 22 days and set a Guinness World Record. It started on December 15th, ironically enough, the same day that Fresno State and Arizona State were in the Las Vegas Bowl. None of us took it personally. The fact that they didn't come to Fresno, of course, it would have been difficult to get to the other bowls that they went to on that day in the Southeast. But I told Brian it was such a cool thing that they were planning. Once the journey was over, or at least the last day of the journey here at the national championship game, I wanted Brian to come on with me, and he is doing that right now. Mr. Richardson, Happy New Year to you. Welcome back.
Happy New Year, Christopher. Thanks for having me on.
All right, where are you right now? Are you in one of the tailgating areas? Are you inside the stadium? Are you en route?
Yeah.
Are you on the Trojan private jet? Where are you?
We're at the All-State Championship tailgate. I just had to walk out there because it was so loud inside. I'm kind of in the back lot here, so it's a little quieter. But yeah, it's Keith Urban's playing here in the background, and there is a ton of fans here. Certainly, the most that we've seen at any bowl game we've been to.
Let's go back to the beginning. How did the first day go? Did you make it to everything? And if so, did you have any hiccups on the way?
Well, so yeah, the first day was the toughest with the three bowls in one day. Scott, our driver, drove about 109 miles an hour to get to the New Orleans Bowl, which was the third one in that first day. We all thought Bowlmageddon was going to be cut short to just one day. Fortunately, we did make it. We had a couple that we couldn't attend because of weather, which we knew might happen. The Bahamas Bowl had a storm coming through at that same time, so we could not make that one. And then there was one in Texas, I think, that was either the next day, I believe it was the next day, that was canceled for weather too. So we've forced through it, and we've had a great time, and it's appropriate that I'm talking to you at this bowl game because you're the first one that that we talked to on that first day, so we appreciate that.
Well, that's cool to hear, but we appreciate you taking time. I mean, you're at the big All-State party, and that sounds like a blast. We're going to be over there, not at the party, but we'll be at the stadium right when the program is over. The second bowl, are you talking about the one, the Boise State Boston College one, the First Responder Bowl?
Yes. Yeah.
That's okay.
We did attend that one.
Oh, you did? Okay, you got to. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
We attended that. We were on the field. We took some pictures. So that does count as one of the bowls. I just can't remember. All the bowls kind of stick together right now. People ask me about, do you remember who played in this one?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, let me think about it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've been wondering about as you've been on this journey is you went to some bowls that were a little larger and some other bowls that were a little smaller in stature. Not small for the teams or the fan bases involved, but relatively speaking, some that just weren't at the level as others. Which ones stuck out for you? Was it the bigger ones or the smaller, more intimate ones?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I really love the smaller bowls, to be honest with you. I've been to some of the bigger bowls, you know, like I said, in the Pete Carroll era, you know, we were going to Rose Bowls and national championships and been to a lot of those, but going to like, you know, a Camellia Bowl in Alabama, in Montgomery, you know, some of these smaller bowls, the Boca Raton Bowl, was a smaller bowl, but you know, Florida really knows how to put on a bowl. I mean, they really, had a fantastic, bowl there in Boca Raton. So I would say just seeing the fans, you know, in these games, you know, what we learned is they're not selling a lot of tickets, especially these early games. I mean, you know, the First Responder Bowl, even before the lightning came, they literally had like 1,000 fans there. I mean, it was kind of depressing. Yeah. So you got to appreciate the fact that these smaller schools, man, they're getting out there and they love their teams just as much as the Clemsons and the Alabamas.
We're talking with Brian Richardson. He is one of a band of, I'm not going to call them vagabonds, but rather trailblazers, guys that decided to head out on the road and do what baseball fans often do in the summer. When fans go up to the Northeast and they'll go to Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park and Citizens Bank Field in Philadelphia, they went on a bowl adventure. Did you find as you were going, you know, as your trip was progressing, that people in sites that you were about to get to were starting to get word about you and people wanted to meet you guys?
Yeah. In fact, it kind of caught fire a lot more than we thought it would. We started, you know, a lot of the bowl directors and the PR people would reach out to us, finding out that we were coming to the game. And we had one of our, we called him the Tweet Monkey. He was busy on Twitter all day long, just reaching out to people and having fun with that. And so a lot of them would call and say, hey, we've got tickets for you guys, or we'd like you to come to the VIP party. And they really embraced us and took us in. And we, you know, at the end of the day, we just, you know, we wanted to, you know, bring people in and enjoy the fact that not only we are doing this, but just enjoy the game, enjoy football.
Yeah. No doubt about that. was there a fan base? Was there a fan base or any particular fan or fans that stick out to you as, my gosh, these folks are nuts in a good way, or these folks are nuts in a not so good way? Anybody come to mind?
Well, we had a lot of fun with the Marshall group, and that was, I believe that was in Tampa. I want to say it was a Gasparilla Bowl. I'm not 100% sure.
Can I just say, when folks in West Virginia get out of West Virginia, they go crazy.
Yeah. you know, like I said, I think the Marshall people stand out just because we had such a great time with them. They kind of brought us in and we tailgated with them before the game. We tried to keep, kind of neutral as fans, but we couldn't help rooting for Marshall during that game. But yeah, a lot of the fans that Alcorn State fans are pretty crazy. They love their football. So that was another fun game. But yeah, it was interesting to see the different, like you said, and the different regions, and they do go a little crazy for their football.
You mentioned Alcorn State. I'm assuming their band was there.
Oh yeah, and we made sure we stayed for
yes.
that.
Yes. Yeah, you led me right into this because, you know, all of you went to USC, and so did I, and SC has one of the finest bands in the United States. Depending on what group of fans you talk to, there's a group of bands that are just above everybody else at the FBS schools, USC, Michigan, Ohio State, Alabama, LSU, and so I'm leaving some out. But Alcorn State's band, I want to get your impressions on it. They can play with anybody.
Oh yeah, we're standing there, and in fact, you know, one of the guys said, "Hey, we got to get a jump on the next game," and we all looked at each other and we said, "Man, listen, you know, we're college football fans, and we know how this band, the reputation of this band at Alcorn State, we got to stay here," and we're glad we did. Man, they were rocking the house, and people were just going absolutely crazy. So we're happy we waited that extra 20 minutes before we left.
Did you, we're talking with Brian Richardson, he of the Bullmageddon Gang. Did you have any hiccups in terms of flat tires, car problems? You had to, you know, a plane didn't show up and so on. Anything like that?
Well, it's a funny story. We did get a flat tire literally right when we left the airport in Florida. I think it was Miami. And this was probably the luckiest break we had the entire trip. A guy flagged us down, pulled us over. We thought he was, he was flagging us down for Bullmageddon because we had the magnets on the side of the car already. And he told us we had a flat tire. We looked to the right, 20 feet to the right was a Goodyear tire place. So we just literally pulled in 15 feet, left the car there, went and got lunch, got the tire fixed, and we're on our way to the next game. It was pretty funny.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned, and I don't want to go too inside baseball here, but you mentioned Scott, your driver, who was going 109, and of course he is the nephew of one of our owners, and that kind of, let's just call it driving prowess, seems to be a family thing with them.
Is that right? Well,
yeah,
boy, it sure scared us.
Yeah, well,
that's not mentioning. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just because I know he's listening, and that's as far as I'm going to go with it.
Well, I was going to say that's 109 miles per hour in the rain, at the same time. So we've got a couple of elements there added to the speed.
How many places that you went when people started to catch on to what you were doing? How many times did people just want to buy you beverages or food or have you stop at the house or come on and join our tailgate, that kind of thing?
You know, it as we got momentum, like in the middle of the trip, it happened quite frequently. We'd go into like local. And again, you know, we try to make food a big part of it. I think I mentioned that at the beginning. You know, just kind of the local, you know, the local cool spots we'd go to. And we started, you know, kids or people there were like, "Hey, the Bullmageddon guys," and they take our picture with us, and a lot of that happened when we got a spot on at the New Orleans Bowl. They put us on national TV, and we heard from probably 100 of our friends, you know, via text, "Hey, I just saw you guys on TV," and our response to each other was, "I can't believe these guys are watching this game."
fantastic. Folks, so you can email me as Christina did. You can email me cgp@940espnfresno.com. Christina asks, did the canceled games ruin their Guinness record attempt?
No. No, we still got credit. The game actually played for a few minutes before it was canceled. So no, it did account for the Guinness Book. And we heard probably three quarters of the way through our trip that there was a current record of 10. So we've already beat that record. So all these games are kind of gravy.
Yeah, you wiped that one out completely. How difficult was it? This might sound like an odd question, but how difficult was it to pack? Because you're at games in Florida, you went to games in Arizona, but you also you were scheduled to go to a game the day after Christmas in Minnesota, and as well as one in New Hampshire. Were you not?
Yeah, I think the New Hampshire. We definitely did not go to New Hampshire, but your packing question is a good one because you're right. We had a couple of games where we wore shorts. Mike Arnold, he wears shorts in 20-degree weather. He's one of our guys. And then we have Toyo, who's from Kauai. We call him the mayor of Kauai. He wears flip-flops in any weather, never took them off. So those guys packed rather easily. The rest of us we're, planned a little bit better with some warm and some clothes, some cold clothes.
So is tonight, what number is tonight? Is tonight 15, 14, 16, 18?
Yeah,
where are you
tonight
at?
Tonight is 15, and we are debating whether or not to go to the Senior Bowl in Alabama, which would be 16. That's still in talks. So right now we've already crushed the record pretty well, but we're thinking we may want to add one more, but then again, there's always next year. If the Trojans don't make a bowl game, we want to be able to beat our own record.
Well, before I forget, I'm going to extend an invitation to you and the boys right now for our Game Day Live 2-hour pregame show. I suspect that we will be down at the Coliseum. As you know, Fresno State comes in for Fresno State for the Bulldogs' first game, and that'll be a lot of fun. So I just want to put that in your back burner that assuming we go down there, you'll certainly have an invitation to come join us for a segment up on stage.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. I'm looking forward to that game. Well, as a Trojan, I'm not looking forward to that game because the Bulldogs are looking tough these days. So
yeah,
I'm a little weary of that one.
Yeah, well, as well you should be. I've just because I get to see them week in and week out, and they are tough. Last thing for you, what's your sense about tonight? Clemson, Alabama. We had one of our team in the stadium saying there's a lot more Clemson fans in there than Alabama. When I was at Media Day, I've been here since Friday. When I was at Media Day on Saturday, there were a lot more Alabama fans than Clemson fans. What's your take about the fan makeup, and who do you like tonight?
I have seen a lot of Clemson fans, and maybe it's just the orange sticks out, but there seems to be a lot more. On the flight over here, I was telling an Alabama fan, I said, I honestly think Alabama's going to win this handily. I mean, maybe not handily, but maybe a couple touchdowns. I said, if Clemson had Deshaun Watson, I might feel a little different, but I just feel that Alabama's got too much firepower.
Folks, he's Brian Richardson, part of the Bowlmageddon gang. What a great thing. They set the Guinness World Record for the most bowls in a certain period of time, a short period of time. Brian, listen, enjoy yourself tonight. It should be a great game, and we'll be in touch in the future for sure.
Christopher, thanks for having me on. We really enjoy your show, and I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you, sir. Much, much appreciated. That's Brian Richardson from Bowlmageddon. What a cool thing.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up in a couple of minutes, talk with Tony Landry, Friday Picks, four games coming your way this weekend. Of course, Tony and I have been doing this all season. Tony is at 90 wins, 50 losses, and 2 ties. I'm at 95, 45, and 2. Tony's going to need some help. Need some help here, so we'll see what happens. Tim Tebow has gotten engaged, and he is engaged to a former Miss Universe. just brings to mind, I put a tweet up about this a few minutes ago, not so much about his getting engaged. I still don't understand the negativity that this guy takes. This guy is a genuinely, seems like a genuinely good guy. I don't know him. I've never met him, never talked to him. I know I've got pretty good friendships with some people who do know him and say the same, that the guy is just he's a positive force. He's always just exuding positivity, and he's a team player in every environment he's in, whether it's in a minor league clubhouse, whether it was with the Broncos or the Jets, certainly as a Florida Gator. But for some reason, the guy is just a magnet for people ripping on him, and I don't really understand. At a time, and I put this out on Twitter, at a time when we seem to revel and celebrate in the plethora of players in every sport, both in professional ranks and to a lesser extent college, guys making headlines for all the wrong reasons far too often. We will report it, we'll talk about it, we get obsessed by it. You have a guy like Tebow who is at the diametric opposite end of the spectrum, and it's almost as if too many folks can't relate to somebody who is so up and positive and good-natured and seems like a genuinely good guy. And because of that, well, we got to cut him down. Got to cut the guy down. Must be something wrong there. Must be an agenda there. It's got to be something that he's hiding. Nobody is that friendly and happy, and I just don't buy it. So that's why, I think that we will see him play this year if he's healthy. I think we will see him at some point with the Mets. Maybe not for a long period of time. Maybe if he has a good year. Maybe it won't be till September. But I do believe that we're going to see him with the Mets. And again, you see people all over social media and to a lesser extent mainstream media hoping for the guy to fail. I hope the guy's successful. I'd love to see him make the parent club and be a contributing member of the New York Mets. I'd love to see that. Coming up, Friday Picks, Tony Landry. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
The studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two, CGP Friday. It's a foggy Friday. It begins right now, 3 minutes, 9 seconds past the hour of 8 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Glad to have you aboard. Been a fun week. Started in San Jose and Santa Clara, ending here in Fresno. Always good to be back here at the downtown studios. Every Friday during football season, sometimes a little bit after football season, we have our Friday Picks segment. Some might call it the most exciting 20 minutes in radio. Others would just say, nah, I use it as a snooze button, which is not at all a reflection on my talented friend who joins us from Sirius XM, the producer, executive producer, and do everything for Big Ten This Morning, Mr. Tony Landry. Tony, how are you?
The snooze button would make a great nickname, wouldn't it?
It would.
Not
I think
a good
so.
One, but
yeah.
That maybe the podcast I'll never launch. I'm going to call the snooze button.
I know you saw the pictures, the many pictures that I put up for my time up in San Jose and Santa Clara, and we had Radio Row was called Audio Avenue, and it was great. It was a great experience. They always are. And, you had a couple of groups off to my left, Bleacher Report and some others. They were doing simulcasts on television. You had stations from flagship stations from Clemson and from Alabama and another station from Alabama as well. Fox Sports Radio was there. Matt had a chance to have a chat, a conversation, nice conversation with Clay Travis. And at the far end.
Clay Travis has nice conversations. That's unheard of.
You know, he's a good guy. I got to tell you. He was a genuinely good guy. It was much like when I had my 3 or 4 minutes with Nick Saban. I was shocked to get so much depth. I mean, you heard the interview that I did with him, the one question that I had with him, but the depth and the, you know, just very warm. He was very warm to everybody, very friendly. Dabo Swinney was very cool. I mean, very engaging, very entertaining. But at the end, about 20 feet from me, was the Sirius XM people. And I don't know what to think about this, because I asked, it seemed like a rotating band of folks that kept going there, and I kept asking every one of them, do you know Tony Landry? And everybody kept saying, who? I think you need to be there a little longer, I guess, for them to know who you are. But I know that you have made an impression on the Big Ten folks. So
it's one of those things, had you just asked, like, do you know that guy that text messages people at all hours of the day with a 701 number that long-winded something about joining two guys that get asked questions about their favorite karaoke songs? Or yeah, but I'm starting to wonder if maybe my number is being blacklisted in certain circles here in the media business.
Well,
like, yeah, if somebody asks you to join something called Big Ten this morning, just respond with new number. Who's this?
That's right. It's, you know, because 701, you know, the power of the 701 is, listen, it's the whole state. It's the whole state of North Dakota. Not many states can say that.
No, and neither should they, because, well, yeah, just get bigger.
That's
now,
right.
I mean, let's go completely off the rails for a moment here. Did you see or hear what the states named Dakota are attempting, or at least petitioning, to do?
I'm almost afraid to ask. No, I have not.
There is a petition being filed by a group of people who I can only imagine either enjoy ingesting or drinking far too much of something, but they want to drop the North and South in Dakota and rename the territory as one big state, Megacoda.
Please tell me you're kidding.
Give it a quick Google search.
I will. You've got to be
very
kidding me.
Very much a thing.
So I would think, Tony, because you're from there, I spent 6 years there, I've got to believe that this was initiated by folks somewhere in the wilds of South Dakota, because they're bitter. Number one, the fact that they're south of North Dakota. They feel like that's, you know, they're always looking up to North Dakota. And two, they're also bitter for the fact that North Dakota, I believe, technically was named a state, what became a state before South Dakota. South Dakota debates that. They have a complex about North Dakota. You know that as well as I do.
You know what's weird is I've heard that from both North and South Dakota, because the complex to the north is we're the ones without the heads in the state. So
yes.
No one wins. Not really quite sure why it's two states, but I can assure you I don't know if I'd ever step foot back in it if they named it Megacoda.
No.
My residency card would be burned there going forward.
And what does that do to North Dakota State and the University of North Dakota? How does that impact them?
Oh, can you imagine the inferiority complex that would have to go away when it was just but one state? It would be all the ESPN graphics that were wrong would finally be right, and people might actually get along.
Well, that's even stretching it just a bit. In case you're thinking that we're going into a lengthy dissertation on the history of North and South Dakota, no, we have other business to take care of. This could be the theme song for Megacoda.
It would be a fitting theme song, wouldn't it?
I think so. Tony Landry and I, starting back in... Tony missed week one, but then week two, and going forward, college and professional picks. Tony is 90-50-2. I'm 95-45-2. Tony, you won last week. You were 4-2. I was 3-3. Very well done.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you know, that's it? Okay. I think,
you know, when you're still losing by five, it's hard. You know, it's like trying to remember a couple years back, Cordero Patterson high stepped into the end zone when they're down 35.
Yes, that was a sterling moment for him.
Essentially, that would be what me gloating with my week 27 win when I'm still down five picks.
Well, just to review very quickly, you got Clemson right. You know, being there for that game, it was one of those, I know most watched on TV, but to be there, and I've said this week, Tony, it was interesting early on, you just looking at Bama on the sidelines, there was a tightness about that whole team that I also felt in media day on Saturday. You could just, the Bama players, I mean, to a man that I talked to, and I talked to a bunch, did not have the same air of calm that Clemson did, but I just figured that was just the way they are, but it really played out that way Monday night, did it not?
Yeah, it just kind of felt like one of those things that you watch the, well, the first quarter seemed like we were going to see a 98 to 96 matchup because it didn't seem like anybody wanted to. A Big 12 game almost seemed to break out for a minute there. It was like defense is beyond optional. So it was interesting, and then you just kind of saw that for as much as everybody, and I talked about it all year, you've talked about it, every talking head, you know, this is the Alabama that we've come to know. They've got better athletes. They're faster. They're better. Clemson showed, hey, you know, you won two, we've won two, and this is a team that I don't think people are going to give this Clemson 15-0 team the just due that's probably ever going to get in, you know, the all-time history books. When you go back and see that this is the first team that's gone 15-0 since the 1890s, this is a team of historic ilk. And I think they're just going to be known as the team that blew out Bama that one time with a quarterback with long hair.
Yeah.
So they were the better team.
No doubt. And I put up a tweet about I don't know if you've seen it, but it was the picture that I took before I had a chance to talk. I didn't put up the audio, but a couple of questions that I had with Trevor Lawrence, and I put the picture up. And in a nutshell, he almost sounded and had the vibe of somebody from Laguna Beach. You know, relaxed, poised, thoughtful, and it was, you know, watching him, I was just thinking, yeah, it just seems like a really good guy. And then he went out and savagely lit up Alabama. You just, juxtaposing those two moments for me, Tony, how he was 5 feet from me talking with him on Saturday and what he did not only as a passer, but as a runner, when he would go and initiate contact with his 6'6", 215-pound frame, that kid impressed me to no end.
Yeah, he's something special. When you have guys talking about he could be the consensus number one pick right now as an 18- or 19-year-old kid, you really look and see that this is something that you give him two more seasons under Dabo Swinney to develop. I think the only thing that we've kind of talked about here on Big Ten this morning is, you know, the arm strength is obviously there. That's not a problem. It's the long nature of which he throws a football. He kind of gets a quicker release, and I don't know who in 2 years other than, I don't know, probably the Oakland, well, the Las Vegas Raiders or the Jets are always a dumpster fire, are going to be in the market for a quarterback. They're going to get somebody special.
And one other thing before we jump into these games, one pick that I also lost, of course, was Chicago Bears. I've now got an asterisk on my sheet, my score sheet on that 3-3 week, and all it says is Cody Parkey.
Yeah.
Not fair.
Get off the Today Show, man. You had a tip field goal block. Like we don't need to hear your motivational speech and how you're gonna praise the Lord and try to do better next time. Just go away, Cody.
Yeah, that and the other thing that went away in that game was the Bears' offense. Just stunning, and I. You know, I'm not bitter. I hope the Eagles get annihilated by New Orleans. That's what I'm going to say. That's all I got. That's
not bitter one bit.
All right. The 11-6 Indianapolis Colts go in to face the 12-4 Kansas City Chiefs. You know, Tony, there was a time earlier this year that the Chiefs were getting talked about as though they were a team that might go undefeated. But that was going to be an overwhelmingly difficult task to beat them. But they have shown a little bit of weakness here and there. How do you see this one?
Yeah, you look back on the Chiefs season, and at one point they were the greatest show on turf 3.0 for all the renditions of that silly thing we've heard. But when you've had guys do all the things that they've done all season. I mean, Pat Mahomes was the MVP from what, week one to week 12. I mean, he was the hottest name in football. He was going to obliterate Brady's single season passing record for touchdowns, and he's going to possibly throw 60. And this was the future coming. This Texas Tech and Oklahoma and this air raid offense Patrick Mahomes is going to bring to the NFL. And then people started to figure out kind of how to move things around. how to slow them down. And they're the strangest 12-4 team I remember in recent history. They started off as hot as anybody, hit the brakes a little, and they're going to get to play at home, which, you know, Arrowhead's one of those sneaky, underrated places in all of professional football. It's one of the loudest places outside of Sens, maybe Seattle or the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis, places like that. So they're going to have their home field advantage. It'll be interesting to see if he can rise to the occasion in the playoffs. One bad game and you get that stink of you can't win in the playoffs on you early in your career, and it takes a little while to shake off. On the other side, though, you have the Indianapolis Colts, who just keep going out and proving people wrong. They just keep going out and winning games and doing it in that ho-hum, I have a flip phone and a terrible neckbeard Andrew Luck kind of way that seems to be working for him. Long-winded answer, I'm actually going to go with the road dog in this one. I'm going to go with the Colts.
Well, I like your analysis. The game is, they're expecting some snow in Kansas City. That's not going to affect the Colts, even though they play indoors. I think that the Colts had really, I picked them last week, and they've really showed me something. I think this team going in at 10-6, you know, the old phrase, well, they're the best 2-7 team. I think they're the best 10-6 team, 11-6 team going right now. I like Andrew Luck. I like Andrew Luck in this situation.
Did you say 11-6?
They're 11-6.
Wouldn't they be 10-6? There's 16 games. You also have 11-6 in our email twice. I'm sitting here trying to add all these games. I'm like, when did they?
Well, they won their game.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see what you're doing now.
Yeah. I mean, they did win their game last week. So.
Yes.
So they are 11-6. But I had to think about that for a second as well. I like Andrew Luck in this situation. This team seems rejuvenated even in some of their losses this year. They could have easily been a lot better than their 10-6 regular season record. I'm with you. I like Indianapolis in this game. I think they go in, and no disrespect to the Chiefs and Pat Mahomes, but you know where I asked Sean McDonough on Monday, is the moment going to be bigger than Trevor Lawrence? Trevor Lawrence proved that it was not. I think at this point in the sensational young career of Pat Mahomes, I think this moment is going to be slightly bigger than him, and I'm going to go with Indy just like you. We go down the road. We take the 405, and we look at the 11-6 Dallas Cowboys as opposed to the Chicago Bears. I need to move past it.
Deep breath.
Yeah. Against the 13-3 Los Angeles Rams. Interesting, I saw a graphic on TV a little while ago. Who has more pressure on him, Sean McVay or Jared Goff? Well, the pressure is Jared Goff. But the Rams have shown their defense in the last couple of weeks has shown themselves to be not quite as good as they were earlier in the year. This stadium, for what it's worth, Tony, the Coliseum, I'm going to say, is going to be filled at least by half with Cowboys fans. Your thoughts?
Now, by mentioning the name Sean McVay by both of us, we are both now in line to get NFL head coaching jobs. Fun fact, I don't know if you don't know that or not, but is there anybody there right now that, you know, just come kiss the ring and bow before him and all of a sudden you're going to be the Bengals' new head coach?
Yep.
So that's interesting for a 32-year-old guy that's only in his second season? I can't even remember. Seems like Sean McVay's been around, you know, since he was about 15 coaching in the National Football League.
By the way, weren't you in line for the Troy job that Chip Lindsey got?
Yeah, I really thought I had that one. Yeah. I showed him my Madden reel. I said, listen, I've gone tailgating and had one too many beers and claimed I could throw that touchdown pass at least once or twice in my life. So I thought I had it. I name dropped Sean McVay 6 or 7 times, but I don't know what happened.
At least you were a finalist.
Yeah, you know, it's always fun to be wanted a little.
That's right.
Back to the Rams game. When you look at the talent on these teams, it's interesting. There are two elite running backs. There's some very good receivers on one team. The quarterback play is really what this is going to come down to, and it's which gentleman decides to make fewer mistakes. the Cowboys' defense isn't exactly Hall of Fame worthy. The Rams' defense is supposed to be one of the best in football, but for some reason, like you mentioned, just haven't figured things out in the last few weeks. But they still have Aaron Donald. They still have a number of other guys that can wreak havoc on Dak Prescott, who has shown when things don't tend to go his way, he tends to give the ball to the other team. So I'll go with the Rams in this one, which seems easy, but you're right. It's probably going to be a bigger Cowboy crowd than an L.A. Rams crowd, which is more of an indictment on how well the Cowboys travel than the fact that L.A. has two football teams and they don't care about half of one. So that's more to do to that.
That's right. Well, I tell you what, I think that the Cowboys, I think the Cowboys are going to come in here, and I think they're going to win this game. And I really, part of me wonders if I've been drinking this morning, which I haven't, just coffee. But I really like what I saw from the Cowboys last week, the resolve that they showed. I think that Amari Cooper has rejuvenated that entire football team, not just the offense, not just Dak Prescott, but I think he has thrown life into that whole team. And I think that what he's brought to them in the way of veteran leadership and showing how to go out and be big in the biggest moment, I think that is going to carry them into L.A., and I think the Rams are going to go down. The Rams are clearly the better team. They have more talent on both sides of the ball, but something just tells me that the Cowboys, hard as it is for me to say it, the Cowboys are back. Tony, you and I, 4 or 5 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, were basically, you know, singing the death knell for the Cowboys, and here they are now going in to play L.A.
We brought up this is the game they'll lose to not get them into the playoffs, and here they are just chugging along.
Yeah.
But you in the last, like, 3 weeks have picked, did you pick Michigan in a bowl game? I think you picked Michigan.
I did. I picked Michigan. I picked Michigan over Florida.
You picked Notre Dame, and you've now picked the Cowboys.
You know what? I just need a cleansing. I need to go sit in front of some incense and, you know, have some green tea and just let my mind sort of clear and cleanse and get back to normal, because I'm troubled by that trifecta that you just, you know, the Michigan, Notre Dame, Cowboys trifecta. I'm feeling a little clammy, man. Ugh.
Yeah. Light a candle, sit in quiet, listen to some Pink Floyd, man.
Russ is lighting a candle for me right now. I really appreciate that. The 13-4 Los Angeles Chargers going in to take on Tom Brady and the New England Patriots at 11-5. The Chargers have become a very sexy pick. That seems to be the word that we like to use now, as a team that could maybe run the table in terms of the, you know, winning a couple of games in the playoffs and getting to the Super Bowl. You're playing New England, where it's almost impossible, it seems, to beat them when we get to the playoffs. It's impossible to beat them at that stadium. What do you think?
This is the game that you'll hear the phrase more this week than you'll hear it ever, well, until next year, if he's still around. If he's going to do it anytime, it's got to be this year. If the Chargers are going to win one for Phillip Rivers, this is his year to do it. This game would have a much bigger feel if it wasn't at Gillette Stadium. Not Gillette Stadium. If it was, is that where I get up at 4:00?
I think it is. I
think it might be.
Yeah.
I think that Robert, if it wasn't at Robert Kraft's house, it,
yeah, it
is
Gillette Stadium.
Much different, it would have a much different feel and a much different vibe. The Sharks are in the water waiting to anoint the Patriots dynasty dead. Everyone's more interested in doing that than the Phillip Rivers angle in this game. Of all of the games, the pick, which includes next, the one we're going to do next, this is the one I've hummed and hawed the most on, because I really do think the Chargers offense is good enough to hang with Tom Brady and the Patriot offense. It's just Phillip Rivers hasn't had any kind of success the deeper he goes in the playoffs, and Tom Brady has, we'll call it marginal success, the deeper he goes in the playoffs. I have no feeling other than just stupidity, and I really want to do it because he wears bolo ties and has 19 kids. I'm going with the Chargers in this one.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm going with the Chargers as well. I think the Chargers' secondary is going to be more than enough of a match for Tom Brady. This team is on a roll. I think the Chargers can make it all the way to the Super Bowl at this point. I don't think I don't think Sony Michel, you know, since he's come back, he hasn't been as effective as he was earlier in the year before his injury. I like the Chargers in this game. I like everything that you said. I mean, it's a little bit, you know, part of me wonders why I would be going against the Patriots at home, but I think that the Phillip Rivers, if not now, when I want to hear more Phillip Rivers post game, because I, you know, he sounds like he's ready to merge into the WWE.
At any point, if you gave that guy a horse, he would ride into battle. Like he sounds like what I would imagine Teddy Roosevelt sounded like.
He's that's nice.
Always
like
ready
that.
To go.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and I think that there's got to be an element, for what it's worth, at the professional level. There's got to be an element of the Chargers hearing that going into New England, and it's the Patriots, it's Belichick, it's Brady. Of course, the Chargers cannot go in there and win. I thought that Jacksonville should have beaten them last year. They had a great first half. They got ultra-conservative in the second half, and they basically played right into the Patriots' hands. I'm not going to say they gave it to them, but they did everything they could to give it to them and then couldn't get it back. So I'm with you. I like the Chargers in this game. Last game, the 10-7 Philadelphia Eagles go in to take on Drew Brees and the 13-3 New Orleans Saints, Tony.
This is this could be fun, or this could be what happened the last time they squared off in New Orleans and Drew Brees hangs 44 and the allure of Nick Foles dies for one more season. This is interesting. Nick Foles has kind of had the pixie dust sprinkled on him in the last few weeks and keeps coming up roses in everything he does. When you match these two teams up offensively, you look and go, there's no reason that the Saints shouldn't win by 30-plus points because they're a better football team. The Saints' defense played marketably better than I think a lot of people thought they would this season. The Eagles' defensive line is something to be messed with, though, starting up front with Fletcher Cox and everything that they have the ability to do. Drew Brees, obviously not the most mobile of people. You're going to get a lot of Taysom Hill, which I have no issues with Taysom Hill. I'm sure he's a great guy. Pays his taxes, does everything, but put another glove on or take one off. You don't get to wear just one and play 17 positions. I understand that's an absurd thing to be upset about, but I'm an absurd human being that's had too much coffee this morning. I'm picking the Saints, even though I don't like Taysom Hill.
Well, I am also going to pick the Saints. I think that Eagles are a good football team. Nick Foles definitely has some sort of dust that has been sprinkled on him. The guy is unbelievable. I mean, going back to the playoffs last year, while he wasn't great in that Atlanta game, he did enough to win. And then, of course, he just took off with Minnesota, with the Patriots, and then came into Chicago and certainly played a good game. I think that going into that environment, I think that they're going to – I just think that Drew Brees is going to be too tough. And Fletcher Cox and that defense is outstanding, but I think the Saints are going to win this game, and I think they're going to win big, Tony.
It has the matchup, or it has the makeup to be that way, doesn't it? Where you could look at it and go, oh boy, that second quarter when they went 21 unanswered got out of control.
Yeah, there's no doubt, and it's interesting because you look at for what it's worth, you look at Philadelphia Eagles beat writers, and they're all pretty split. A lot of them, some of them are thinking the Eagles are going to win in a shootout. I don't see that happening. Last thing I want to ask you about is your beloved Green Bay Packers, and we talked about this on the program here yesterday. Matt LaFleur, did you have Matt LaFleur in the Green Bay Packers coaches pool?
I, on three separate occasions, while talking to family members or other media members, have had to Google what the Packer head coach's name is again. I don't get it, but I don't think it's probably the worst thing that a casual fan as myself, not the, you know, the elite super fans that I'm sure were looking through message boards to find out who these guys could hire, are. I think the sexy name to re-steal, you know, your phrase from earlier was Josh McDaniels.
Yeah.
But I don't also think Josh McDaniels is going to be the head coach people think he's going to be now that he's got some time to learn under Belichick after his first foray into it in Denver. But it's one of those things where if he wowed the people in Green Bay, and I'd like to think, even as a fan, that you don't just get wowed into hiring somebody just because he knows Sean McVay and is an offensive coordinator, that something has to be going right. He's a young guy. He's an offensive-minded guy. I'm sure Aaron Rodgers is probably excited that, you know, it's a young new name that people are excited about, but it's definitely something that I looked at and went, who?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the era that we're in now. We've gone from the days of the older, crusty Bill Parcells types. Now we're going to guys, you know, I mean, the next step is to get guys coming right out of college. Well, he was a grad assistant. He's 24, but I think he can do it. We're going to hire him. How long does LaFleur last if, after a year or two, the Packers aren't lighting it up?
I would give him, they'll give him the first year because usually outside of a few people, you get the first year. If things after year two are uneasy, the seat will get too hot. They'll get rid of him. You got to think Aaron Rodgers is 35. There's only so many more years that he can be the Aaron Rodgers that he is now before you really have to go out and capitalize on that, or you're gonna waste away one of the best quarterbacks of all time with one Super Bowl win. So I would give him 2 years for sure.
I'm looking forward to seeing when Aaron Rodgers hangs it up, when Danica Patrick starts training him to be a driver. I think that'll be a bit of fun.
Anything better than those awful State Farm commercials he does.
I'm really tired of those, too. Tony Landry, producer of Big Ten This Morning, Sirius XM, joins us every Friday for Friday Picks and joins us Tuesday when his schedule allows. Tony, always a great pleasure, my friend. Enjoy the games this weekend. We'll talk next week.
Sounds good. You have a good weekend, sir.
All right. TLCG coming up. Nick Shager and your weekend movie preview. This is the CGP.
There may be no busier film critic, no greater elite movie mind than Nick Shager. He can talk Hollywood, Cannes, Sundance, Fargo, Budapest, Kathmandu. If there's a film to be seen or a film festival to attend, he is on it. Here's Nick Shager.
A lot of people don't know that when you hear big voice guy saying he is on it, there's about 50 people out on Fulton Street here chanting along with him, welcoming in our guy from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire, Mr. Nick Shager. Nick, how are you?
I'm good. Happy Friday, Christopher.
Happy Friday to you. You've had a chance to kind of work through the Saints loss after, you know, you went and visited there and what have you. I'm still getting through the Bears loss. Without realizing it, I brought it up three times on the show today, but that's another story.
I bet.
So this weekend is a mixed bag, as most weekends are, but we're going to start with Project Blue Book. And this has a bit of X-Files in it, or at least sort of floats around it. I was a big X-Files fan once I understood sort of how the show worked. Project Blue Book, I've read your thoughts on it, and it's on History Channel. Anytime anything involves aliens or the potential for aliens or UFOs, and in this case combining it with Fargo for an episode, I'm in.
Well, yeah, Project Blue Book is definitely in X-Files terrain. It's a new series. It premiered this past Tuesday on the History Channel. And, yeah, it is very much cut from an X-Files mold. It is about two investigators, one who is a young Air Force official and another who is a professor of aerospace physics, I believe, who is brought in to lead the Air Force's investigations into UFOs in the wake of Roswell and everything else, because the show is set in the late 40s, early 50s. And so the hook of the show is that it's based on real events. The main character is a guy named Dr. J. Allen Hynek, and he really was a guy who was hired by the Air Force to investigate flying saucers. In fact, he's the guy who, at least the show claims, coined the term UFO. And so the show uses his actual cases as the premise for standalone episodes. Of course, they're embellishing this dramatically. And then they tie in a larger conspiracy here because we really want to get into X-Files territory. So the government is sort of hiding things and knows more than they're letting on, and the investigators have to sort of figure out what the truth of things are. Aidan Gillen, who was in The Wire and who people know probably best from Game of Thrones, where he played Littlefinger, plays Hynek, and he is the best reason to watch the show because he is the sort of expert, or the guy who becomes the expert and is a skeptic and wants to prove you know, everything via science, but also then becomes the sort of Fox Mulder, the true believer. The show also throws in some sort of Cold War espionage with Russian spies, so you get a little bit of almost like the Americans thrown in. The show is not fantastic, but it works. And as I said, Gillen really sort of holds it together. So people who are feeling like, you know, they have that craving for X-Files-ish conspiracy theory, you know, sort of sci-fi stuff, it will more than fit the bill.
And I mentioned Fargo because the first episode, if I'm not mistaken, centers in or around Fargo, does it not?
It does, yeah. The first episode takes place in and around Fargo. It begins, the first story is about a pilot who has a run-in with what appears to be a UFO, and his story actually winds up being sort of the through line for the show's conspiracy-oriented narrative, even though each subsequent episode also has, you know, individual cases that they're looking into. So, yeah, it sort of travels around the country. It gives you, you know, pretty good slice of 1950s American life, certainly scientific, the sort of scientific arena of the 1950s, as you'd expect from a History Channel show. But you know, let's just say this isn't totally factual history we're dealing with here.
And don't you think though that with shows like this, whether it's Project Blue Book or going back to the X-Files, part of the lure or the attractiveness of shows like this is you're playing to both sides of the fence. On the one side, the people who are very much into UFOs, and I don't mean, you know, the folks who are going to Roswell and waiting for the arrival, but people who are just fascinated by the science of it and whether or not it's legit and approaching it from the astronomy, you know, that sort of side of it, you're going to get that crowd. And then the doubters, that crowd, they're going to tune in and watch it as well because they want to have more reason to say, see, this is why this is so ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think this show does that in the same way that The X-Files does, right? By having two main characters, one of whom is more the skeptic, one of whom is more open to the idea of it, and that sort of conflict and dynamic guiding the show. And this show actually works that even more because the two protagonists are actually tasked with disproving UFO sightings. That's sort of their assignment from the government. So there's a lot here where some of the stories that they investigate don't pan out and aren't really real. And so, yeah, there really is something to that. And since some of these cases are based, as I said, on real life cases and real life sightings and real life supposed encounters, there is a real sort of skeptical aspect going on here, even though, as you might imagine, the show definitely is sort of pro UFO.
That's good for me. I'm pro UFO. We're talking with Nick Shager from Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. Pledge is coming out, and I think back to my college days. I had no desire to be in a fraternity, partly because of some of the things that. Well, I mean, I had enough friends in the dorms, and that was enough. But part of it was the pledging rituals and the things that I saw some of the pledges being made to do. I thought, no, not in this or any other lifetime. But this movie takes it to a different extreme, does it not?
It does. You know, we've had a few movies actually over the last couple of years that have dealt with this same topic. One was called Goat that starred one of the Jonas Brothers, and was actually quite good. And another one that was about African-American fraternities called Burning Sands, which I believe came out last year and had Trevante Rhodes. Both of those were very good. They tackled it from a dramatic standpoint. Here, Pledge definitely is a horror film. So you might imagine, you can naturally sort of imagine that the story goes into really sort of darker, more extreme terrain. It's a pretty standard setup. It's about three guys who are sort of, you know, quote unquote losers. They can't get into any of the fraternities at their university because they're sort of dorks and nerds. And they wind up getting invited by some beautiful girl to come to a party. It's at a mansion where they're sort of strangely accepted into the ranks and asked, along with a couple of other guys, to pledge. What follows, as you might imagine, is not exactly normal or cool, and I won't give anything away, but the story is clearly playing off the idea that pledging, and in particular the hazing rituals that go into pledging, are often extreme and unpleasant and trying, and this just takes that to the utmost horrific extreme. And I, what I liked about that was not only that the story is really well done and it's a very short, concise, efficient horror movie, but it doesn't preach anything about pledging or hazing. It's all right there in the story. It has sort of a grisly, sort of tongue-in-cheek humor about, you know, what hazing is. You know, there's one point at which the characters are going through these horrific things, and they have to convince each other to stay, saying, no, 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 it's just hazing. No, no, this is what fraternities do. Now, of course, I don't really think fraternities go this far, but there is a critique of the entire system and process, because any sane person wouldn't stick around with this the moment it started. But we have a system in place where people are expected to suffer some to be in fraternities, and certainly this film has some fun with that idea.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that this is very Shakespearean. There's no subtext here.
That's right. Very, very Shakespearean, but with a lot more blood.
Okay, so there will be blood. All right. That's fantastic. We're talking with Nick Shager, movie critic for Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, and Esquire. The upside, the thing that jumped out at me right off the bat about this film is the combination of the stars here, Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart. I think Nicole Kidman's in this as well. But when I'm going to have you roll it out, because I certainly can't, but just seeing Bryan Cranston and Kevin Hart together, that almost seems like a bit of an unusual combination.
It is. It's quite an odd combination, and I think that's what the film is going for as its sort of hook. It's a remake of a French film called The Untouchables from a few years ago, and actually The Upside here has been sitting around for a couple of years because of Harvey Weinstein and that entire mess. The story is about a man who both loses his wife and, because of an accident, winds up a paraplegic, played by Bryan Cranston. And those twin tragedies, or catastrophic events, at least, make him lose the will to live. And so he decides he wants to get an aide who will be the least likely to sort of get in the way of him sort of committing suicide or dying. And so he hires the most unlikely person possible, who turns out to be Kevin Hart. Of course, that leads to all sorts of sort of mismatched, you know, comedic possibilities, because they come from different worlds and they teach each other about each other's lives and about each other's sort of, yes, you know, sort of circumstances. I found the film to be really cliched and corny in a way that almost doesn't work at all. What salvages it is that Cranston and Hart are both very good in it. Even though there are every sort of scenario is really sort of groan-worthy and makes you want to roll your eyes. But Cranston, you know, still has a really light touch. He's been doing so much dramatic work the last few years that I think people forget that he can be quite lively and funny. And this is a film that really gives him an opportunity to do that. And he's sort of well paired in an unlikely mismatched way with Hart, who, of course, is a funny guy. And so they wind up making the film, I think, a lot more tolerable than it otherwise would be or should be. I don't think it's going to be something that people remember years from now, but you could do worse, if only because it really is a film that shows that, you know, movie stars can carry even subpar material.
Coming up, one more thing with Nick Shager. We're going to give you a movie about a dog. We're going to talk about Keanu Reeves. And we're going to talk about a word that I have never known until this morning. The word is treacly. One more thing is next. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
One more thing this week with our good friend Nick Shager, film critic, Variety, Daily Beast, Yahoo Movies, Esquire. I am not a fan of movies that chronicle animals. I love animals. I just don't want to see animals on screen, talking or otherwise, which brings me to the word treacly, from the noun treacle, meaning cloying, sentimentality, or flattery. It's a word that I've never heard of before. I've learned it today, thanks to Nick Shager. You call this a treacly movie, and not even before I even watched the trailer and read up on it, as soon as I saw the synopsis, I thought, yep, if we're going to use the word treacly, this is it.
Yeah, if you're interested in treacly animal movies, then certainly A Dog's Way Home is going to fit the bill. It's a film based on a novel by an author named W. Bruce Cameron, who actually wrote the novel that last year's movie, or 2 years ago's movie, A Dog's Purpose, was based on. Yeah. So Cameron has sort of cornered the market currently on dog stories. Yeah. This one, unlike A Dog's Purpose, was about a dog spirit that kept getting reincarnated in various different dogs. This one is about one dog, voiced by Bryce Dallas Howard, although the dog doesn't speak. You hear the dog's thoughts. It's about a dog who gets adopted by a couple, and everything is great until the dog winds up being banned from living in, I believe it's Denver, the Denver area where they are currently residing. So the dog gets sent away to New Mexico to stay with one of the owner's relatives. And the dog doesn't like this and decides to journey back home to find her owners. Along the way, there's a lot of really sort of cornball encounters with evil dog catchers, and there's, most strangely, with a homeless veteran who the dog winds up getting handcuffed to when the homeless person dies. It's a very odd movie, I'm telling you. But stranger still is that the filmmakers decide, well, what happens in the film is that the dog at one point, one of the key points is that it befriends a cougar, but the filmmakers, of course, are using a real dog for the main character, but they didn't want to use a real cougar as the dog's best friend, so they wind up computer generating the cougar. Oh. And so there's a lot of stuff in the middle of the film that looks very, very odd, because you have real life animals and computer generated animals sort of interacting with each other. That just compounds the fact that the movie is really syrupy. You know, if you're into those kinds of movies, it'll certainly fit the bill. But for my tastes, you know, it's a pass.
Yeah, the last time that I took was with my daughters, and we went to one of these in the theater. It's one of these theaters that has the reclining leather type chairs, and you can be almost horizontal. And I just looked at my daughters and said, "Daddy's going to sleep. Please don't wake me up."
That's right.
You know,
that's always a good dad move.
That exactly. Last movie, one of your favorites, and not mine. Keanu Reeves. When I saw him do Hamlet, I was done with him. Replicas is the movie. Do you like the movie?
No, I love Keanu Reeves. I do not like Replicas. I think Keanu Reeves fans are going to have to wait a few months for the third John Wick film to hopefully get a good film out of him. Replicas is a science fiction film about Keanu Reeves' scientist who is creating synthetic robots that he can place the memories and consciousness of dead people into, which right off the bat sounds like a horrible, horrible idea, but he doesn't seem to see it that way. When his family dies, he gets the idea to bring them back to life. There's some cloning involved too. You can see where this is all going, except you really won't see where it's all going, because there are so many bizarre, bonkers twists in the film. None of them good. The film really plays like an unintentional comedy. And so, unless you really are a Keanu Reeves completist, you can probably skip it.
I like that. Did you say a Keanu Reeves completist?
That's right. Hey, some people need to see all Keanu's work.
Wow, that's all right. All right. I always think that he's doing like a bad Marlon Brando every time I see him. I just you know, from Apocalypse Now, a little bit of mumbling and what have you. But that's just me. We've got about 30 seconds left. Your beloved Saints hosting the Philadelphia Eagles, or as they say in South Philly, the Eagles. Who do you like? I know who you like. What's your score?
Yeah, I'm going to pray that the Saints pull this one out 35-24. I've got a house divided here with a wife from Philadelphia.
Oh.
Things should get pretty heated this Sunday, but I'm hoping Kamara has a big day.
All right. Well, my mom and my mom is a diehard 40-year Eagles fan. She's with your wife on this. Folks, he's Nick Shager, the best in the business. Nick, always a great pleasure. We'll talk with you next week.
Looking forward to it. Have a great weekend.
All right. You too. My thanks to Nick. And to Tony Landry, Brian Richardson doing an encore performance for us, and my guy Russ doing his usual great job today and all week. And thanks to all of you. Folks, a big game tomorrow at Save Mart Center, 5 p.m. The Dogs taking on Nevada, the Wolfpack. It's huge. Hope you show up. We'll see you on Monday. Until then, you're on your own.